Oh, wow. It's such a pleasure to meet you both.
Nice to meet you, too.
Yeah, this, you know, I mean, this project becomes kind of a bigger, you know, our show will be 20 works by Michael Asher, and the Wall is like a really notable one. You know, it's like such a special work. You know, kind of the longest lasting, you know, it was around for decades, and the fact that you guys lived with it and all, I mean, so we're really thrilled to have a chance to talk to you about it.
Oh, good. Okay.
Do you think it's still there, the Wall?
Yeah, the Wall might still be there.
Well, we were going to start there. So someone from the Michael Asher Archive drove by October 1st, and it was just a fully empty lot.
But the outer walls are still there.
But as of last week, they're not.
Oh. Wow, so they must have put up a new wall. They're ready to start showing the house soon.
Well, and part of the funny part of that wall was, as Ellen has always pointed out, it took away part of our property and gave it to the neighbors. So it, you know, so that's kind of an interesting thing. And after we sold the house, which was 2 years ago, September, within a month, the whole place was demolished. I mean, they're doing a spec house.
Yeah, because I went to LA in August with John Knight, who's, you know, when it was a friend of Michael's, we drove out there and we walked the property and actually we saw the wall. You know, it was beat up and there was some cuts in it where they were probably removing conduit maybe, but it was fully intact. And on the neighbor's side, it looked perfect. But then, as you guys said, there was an entirely different kind of like dumpy spec home in its place, and the wall was like a relic. And then we just heard last week from the foundation, they're like, oh, one of our board members drove by just to look at it and then sent these photos where it was now, the wall itself was completely gone. And it looked like they hadn't yet put up the replacement wall. So it was basically just no wall for this period.
And, you know, it was a 100-year-old house. And so, you know, they tore it down for a 16,500 square foot, you know, single family spec house.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it looks like. And of course, the new thing has no character compared to what your house must have been, you know.
The house was amazing. I wish you had seen it.
And so did you guys grow up in that house? Was that your family home from when you were born?
Not from when we were born. Nancy, how old were you?
I was 6. I had my 7th birthday there. It was in 1965.
And Anne was 11.
Right.
So I was 9 or 10, depending on when we moved.
We moved in July, yeah. So we virtually grew up there.
And was it always a house full of art and artists from the outset? Were your parents already collecting and kind of in dialogue with artists?
Yes, they were starting to collect. Gemini was just about to begin. You know, they were in the very starting age. And my dad was on the board of LA County. And it was probably within the first year, maybe 2 years, and tell me if I'm wrong, that LA County asked my dad, because they were doing a Man Ray show, and they asked if he could stay at the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he did. And that was our first artist house guest. And then Gemini started. So we always joke that the first catalog we sent out were Joseph Albers squares. And in the dining room, they set up the dining room table and they had all the kids. Remember, we were like 12 and 11, 6 years old, putting together the catalog to send it out, collating. And they said, one day we'll pay someone to do this. So, you know, so from almost day one. But my parents said that had they not moved into such a funky old big house that we couldn't afford, so therefore they didn't paint for 10 years, the carpeting was ugly for 10 years, because they really stretched it to get that house, they wouldn't have had the life they had, because it was a funky house that everyone stayed in and hung in.
And they started having parties pretty soon after that. They met Larry Bell, and he was sort of the first entree into the LA scene. And so they started having these crazy parties, which started out a little rougher than they ended up. And then at Gemini, during Gemini's time, when my parents were there, all the artists would stay at the house.
Yeah, and they said the first party they had with artists, they invited their friends, and they had Larry invite all the artists. And they said no one talked. It was really weird, just a weird vibe. And then Larry said, well, we felt like zoo animals. You know, we are there to entertain. And then they said, okay, let's do another one. And they supplied the food and the alcohol and said, you do the guest list.
And a jukebox.
So it ended up that my parents just made it a fun place for artists to hang at and not have people look at them like say, oh, I'm at an art party, you know.
So then the artist made the guest list for that party.
The artist made the guest list pretty much from then on. Yeah.
Were you guys at the parties? Like, did you experience them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it got wilder and wilder and wilder.
And it was funny because one of the first, not first, but an early party, it was for Rauschenberg. He was in town. And so I don't know what happened, but he went skinny dipping. And he went running through the house to go into the pool or to dry off or whatever. And someone there belonged to the Brentwood Country Club. And very shortly after, our friends, whose parents belonged to the Brentwood Country Club, weren't allowed to come to our house because it was told that we had orgies every weekend there. So and when we were younger, it was kind of odd for us, you know. But as we got into high school, our friends started realizing, like we did, my parents' parties were far better than any parties we would go to. So everyone started coming to the parties.
And your parents were unique, meaning like this wasn't like one of a number of people doing this. They were kind of the ones, right? I heard stories that artists coming from Europe or from New York, like the Grinsteins were the people they knew and the context in which they socialized.
Yeah, yes, the Quinns, Joan and Jack Quinn, did it to a point. It was more with Andy Warhol and a different group of people. And Anne, again, can correct me if I'm wrong. But it wasn't the same. It was our house. Like my dad said, one day he got a phone call from someone, probably Richard Serra, and said, hey, there's a musician, doesn't have any money. He's coming with his group. Can he stay there? My dad said, sure. And it was Philip Glass, and he was a poor musician. His whole ensemble stayed there on the floor and on the couches and all that. And then Philip just started staying, and he became dear friends with my parents, and they ended up buying a piano for him to practice on. So my parents never said no to someone staying there. My dad would go to the airport and pick up someone he didn't know because someone said, hey, can they stay there?
I might be able to find. We have a video that shows a lot of these artists talking about what it was like growing up at the house. Like, you know, great video, like Frank Gehry and Philip and Ed Ruscha. And, you know, all these people are in this video that's really fun that we showed at his memorial. But we'll try to find it for you guys.
And Frank said something interesting. He said, when we were all struggling and trying to make it, he said, we always knew we could come to the Grinsteins and they would encourage us. Because my dad always said, if you're not an artist, you have to support the artist. And found out from these videos that he had set up, we knew about one account, but he had set up accounts all over town at art stores, at lumber yards, at photography, you know, photo stores for the artist. And he said, police yourselves. Use it as you need it. You need to continue your art. And I don't want to see, I'll just pay the bill, don't worry. And they really police themselves. When Ann, Nancy, and I would try and charge, he would freak out on us. But we learned if we wrote an artist's name, he would never ask. So he really believed, and I know Guy Dill came up to him and wanted a job. And my dad said, why? He goes, I need to support my family. My dad wrote him a check and said, here, this should hold you over. You need to create your art. So they truly were 100%, yeah, patrons.
Now, Jed, what's interesting about what you had just said is a lot of the artists talked about, and this is Ed Ruscha did a great piece at the memorial at LACMA talking about what it was like. Anyway, so the part for them was they were West Coast artists and they would go, you know, to New York and they weren't allowed to talk to any of these guys. They weren't allowed to talk to Jasper Johns or Lichtenstein or Frank or Richard, who would just yell at them anyway. But, you know, or Rauschenberg. So, but when they came to the house, they said it was a level playing field and there wasn't a hierarchy. And you could be in the kitchen eating, you could be in the den drinking, you could be out in the pool swimming, you could be anywhere. And you get to talk to these artists and it made it so the West Coast artists could talk to the East Coast artists that they've never had access to. So that's what was kind of cool. Whenever an East Coast artist was in town, my parents would always have a party and invite all the West Coast artists to come. And so it was a really unusual situation. It was also crossed all lines. There was Christopher Isherwood and Joan Didion, as well as Merce Cunningham and Steve Wright and, like Ellen said, Philip Glass and
William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg,
and Andy Warhol and Leonard Cohen wrote there. And it's like there was just it was just art. It really went all over. I mean, Robert Wilson was there, and you know, so it was. Joan Jonas, and you know, so it really Judy Chicago, and so it really crossed all lines, and everyone was invited, and it was funny because like Ed Ruscha was one of the young artists, you know, as was Guy Dill and Laddie Dill and Tom Woodall, and you know, all those guys were like the young ones. They were like the puppy dogs, and so it was great for them because they had access.
Also, it was nice, like we have pictures, you know, tons of pictures, but there's a great picture of Andy Warhol. My parents gave him his first party when he had his first show here. And he's standing and talking to Chuck Arnoldi and Laddie Dill and my mom. But it's also like everyone goes, oh, my God, wasn't it cool growing up and being raised in that atmosphere? And yes, it was cool being raised in that atmosphere, but these people were not famous. These were the outskirts. These were the people. It wasn't like being raised and having Gregory Peck and, you know, Fred Astaire, people everyone knew. Nobody knew these people until we got into college. And then our friends would start calling us and say, hey, you know.
Wasn't I at a party in your house and that person was there?
Yeah. But it was funny. One of Nancy's best friends was in college, and she had to do a report on Richard Serra. And so Richard was at the house, and she goes, can I interview you? And he goes, no. And she goes, but I have to do a report about you. He goes, give me a tape recorder, give me the questions, and come back in 3 hours.
And those are the kind of things that used to occur. I mean, it was, you know, funny to us. And growing up in that was, like Ellen said, my parents had epic parties. I mean, epic. I mean, people come up to us all the time and like, oh, I was at a party at your parents' house. I was like, yeah, you and everybody else on the frickin' planet. But they were epic because it was so, there was so much permission for anything. And as we've said before, Ellen and I have said, the art wasn't precious. It just wasn't. It was something that was part of my parents' lives. Like my mother said once so poetically, she said, I feel like I'm living with my friends because they're all over all the time.
I could never sell a piece, which she...
Right, and they didn't. And my father was the philosopher. He was into the artist. He was the humanist. And my mother was intellectual, and she was into the art.
And the interesting thing about it was the East Coast artists, because they were starting to get names for themselves, you know, Lichtenstein, Jasper Johns, Rauschenberg, they looked to the West Coast artists because nobody cared about them, because they didn't have gallerists saying, I need you to make me money, you know. So they were more the artists that got to do whatever they wanted and really do their art. And I think the East Coast artists loved coming to LA because they got that feeling that they didn't, they saw the freedom that they want, and they, you know, so I think everybody was getting something from somebody. You know, it wasn't like they were just the big kids in the LA were, I mean, they were crazy and about light and space and about that kind of stuff. So it opened up their eyes to it. Now, our children, my parents' grandchildren, got on the level of knew that they were with famous, you know, artists and used that, because one time Willie came home from NYU. Danielle Buren was at the house. Willie's my son. And Danielle Buren was at the house. And he goes, oh, my God. I just, you know, we had just arrived that night. He had left that day. He goes, we just studied about you yesterday. And Danielle goes, what'd you say? He goes, oh, about this case, about your piece. And he goes, well, what'd they tell you? And he told them. And he goes, oh, that's not what really happened. You know? So he had to go back to school on Monday and say, that's not what happened. So it became fun. It was never like a, oh, guess who I, you know, was just fun. Philip Glass. I have a video of teaching Anne's daughter to play piano. And she wanted to go watch Trick or Treaters instead. So she blew off her piano teacher, Philip Glass, you know. So it was like stuff like that.
Wow. And was there, because it's also so notable that there were these works made for the home, like Richard Serra, Buren. Was that something that gradually happened, that they would not only collect but commission and have things actually made for the... Did that just kind of organically happen as people were spending more and more time there?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was all organic. And at one point, they had given Terrell a deposit because he was going to do the swimming pool. And during that time, David Hockney wanted to do the pool. But they said no, because Terrell was going to do it. And then the pool had to be resurfaced. It ended up being too big of a deal. And all of a sudden, we ended up with this skylight on our stairs. Frank Gehry said it was the very first Terrell skylight thing. Terrell said it was for a minute and then didn't, because we wanted to document that. But he didn't, so it just got destroyed with the house. Richard Serra did some redwood tree logs that weren't commissioned for the house. Richard Serra never did anything for the house. But those got termites and disappeared, and Richard didn't want...
Well, they ended up not to be redwoods. They didn't petrify. So it wasn't just that they got termites. They were not redwoods. But that's all documented.
And then we asked Richard, we'd like to donate it to a museum, and he said, no, piece is gone and done. There was on the wall, Richard Jackson did a big G on the wall, and he said he would redo that piece if someone wanted it, because we have the drawing of it and the canvas. But that hasn't happened. And then the Danielle Buren wall, when we took it down, we cut it up into pieces, and each child and grandchild got a piece.
And then the Asher piece.
And then the Asher piece, which we asked them, do you want us to replay, you know, put it somewhere? And they said no.
Do you remember Asher working on the project and the process, how your parents engaged him, and particularly what the neighbors thought?
The neighbors, I don't remember how they engaged him. Just remember my dad loved Michael Asher. He was one of his favorite people in the world. The neighbors were really upset. And my parents had to explain, you're gaining 12 inches or whatever the thing is, not a big deal. And really had to push it. And they just didn't get it.
Everyone was really straight in the neighborhood. I mean, they were definitely the crazies by far.
The Hearst family lived down the street. And it was a conservative neighborhood. The Hearst family tried getting us kicked out. Didn't succeed.
Did Michael ever engage the neighbors, or was it just your parents who sort of negotiated with them?
I would assume my dad would have kept him away from the neighbors. You know, Michael, I mean, had it been someone like a Richard Serra, he probably would have gone over there and, you know, scared the shit out of the neighbors. But Michael, I think my dad protected him. You know, the neighbors were, you know, when they thought they had vision, you know, where they thought they were cool. And I think that's what happened with the very first party at the house. Oh, we're going to a happening with art, you know, and then they just don't get it. So,
and they're still the same neighbors.
They're still, well, she passed away. He still lives there, the guy, yeah.
But they, you don't think they ever really had an understanding of it? It was something they put up with, but they didn't really understand it at the level that it was meant to be, that project.
Not at all.
No, they didn't like the noise or anything.
Yeah, they didn't like anything about the noise of the house or the people, the parties. Now, I am sure that they tell people at the country club, oh, Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, you know, after the fact, like, oh, we loved it there and blah, blah, blah. Nuh-uh. Didn't have. They were at my parents' memorial and loving all the people there. Uh-uh. they were very conservative and, I mean, nice neighbors, but.
And did you know, because, you know, I guess your family was also friends with Michael Asher's mom, Betty. Did you kind of know Michael as an artist, or did you meet him in the context of his family, or was it kind of all together?
And that's for you.
Well, Betty Asher was a great art dealer. I mean, she was fabulous.
Nancy, did you?
I knew Michael Asher just as an artist because that's how he was introduced to me. You know, but I wasn't old enough to know, you know, where he fit into the big picture. Like Ellen said, everyone was the same to us, you know. So it's, yeah, I just knew him as an artist because that's how he presented.
Yeah. His notes, I don't know if you've seen any of these, but, you know, the way he would approach a project is when he was invited, you know, any show, a show at a museum, but also the show, you know, the project, the commission for your family, he would get a notepad out and just write many, many, many ideas, like one sentence ideas. And there are very funny and very extremely varied ideas of what to do in your house. And I don't know if you've ever seen those proposals.
No, I would love to.
I mean, it was things like move microwave into the living room, or have a second TV with a closed circuit camera filming people watching TV.
Make it so the channels automatically switch.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I want to see some of these. You guys have to hear.
I would love to see that.
But there's just these funny, like, first take ideas. And a lot of them are around the television and the kitchen, or like hospitality, or kind of like conditions of living. And they're really, really funny. Really, it's so colorful and shows the way in which he interrogated all the different ways he might interpenetrate your lives. And of course, it's not adding something new. It's like changing something that's already there. You know, like changing a condition, making a different situation, making something that makes you have to think twice or do something different. And then he finally, you know, after all these notes, lands on this idea of the wall and the property, and that it's such a radical move to like create a situation that gains and loses, that it's not only about you, but it forces a relationship with a neighbor. Like, it deals with so many ideas of exchange and boundary. But you can kind of see the thinking come out of all these sort of wily ideas about interpenetrating activities in the home. So I just thought to mention, yeah, they're really good.
I'm looking at the list right now, and the sixth idea is garbage disposal in the backyard, which honestly doesn't seem that crazy.
That's hilarious.
It's a very slight intervention.
Nancy, he probably wanted to put the garbage disposal in the Lloyd Hamrell.
Right, right, right. Oh, that was another piece that was for the house, the Lloyd Hamrell. It was the rocks that went down. I don't know if you've seen pictures, the rocks that went down in the backyard.
I've seen photos of that, yeah.
Site specific.
And then at the end, everyone took rocks when we had our goodbye party.
Right.
Oh, that's sweet. But the way, but I think the way Asher would work is he would write all these lists. He would think and think and think. He would get to, like, you know, one or more that he would take further. And then finally he would make a proposal. And it seems like the first proposal he actually made was what did happen to do this wall relocation. So he had like identified that. And then your parents seemed completely on board with that from the second he proposed it.
Oh, I can't see my parents saying no to anything unless it was destroy the house, you know, because they respected him so much.
Yeah. And do you remember, I mean, again, this is going back so far, do you remember this proposal being in the air before it was built and kind of like you guys talking about it, or did just something that started to happen?
Nancy, Anne?
We weren't consulted on any of it.
We weren't even consulted when we had to move out of our bedrooms, mostly Anne did, when artists came. We were on a need-to-know basis.
Yeah, yeah. We were just, you know, things to move around.
Well, it is such a provocative artwork because, you know, it changes so many givens in the idea of, like, property without actually, with the idea being that it didn't add or subtract, it just moved, you know, but it, like, it's so endlessly interesting. So I'm sure it was a provocative piece.
And it's also about walls, and it's about boundaries, and it's about so much, especially if you're doing it on your own property. It's like, well, that's kind of an interesting, provocative, you know, idea as well, you know, putting boundaries on your own property. And so I think you're right. It was very, and it was at the entrance to the house. It's the first thing you see on the left. You know, it was the first thing you saw was when you drove in the driveway, you saw that. That was the first thing.
Also, it was interesting because it wasn't so noticeable. It was very subtle. So you had to be paying attention to notice it. Like, why is that wall pushed in? So it made you stop and look.
Yeah. And there's a, that's so like his work. It's like there's a radicality, but there's a subtlety because it's so seamless. So it like makes you think twice. But then the more you think about it and look at it, the more kind of deep it gets. I mean, that seems so the epitome of his, the way he worked.
Do you remember people just happening upon it and asking like, what, it, why is this
That happened
wall?
A lot at that house. You know, we had the Carl Andre bricks. So, you know, it's, you know, we had the A through Z boxes. We had so much, we had the milk bottle, you know, we had so much stuff that was normal that if you didn't know what you were looking at, that you wouldn't know. So I think it was funny. So the answer is yes and no is the answer to that question. And it's the kind of thing that that's what opened up everyone's brain is that anything and everything is art. So, you know, when my parents passed away and we were trying to get work for the archives and, you know, place these pieces in certain museums and do it, all the stuff that we did, led by Ellen, it was like, well, is this art? Was this art? You know, we always had to say, we have to make sure we're not throwing something out that we didn't know. And so that question came up a lot.
And it, Nancy and I, when we cleaned the house, and Ann, I'm sure we threw out art pieces, you know. And it's interesting, kind of off topic, but on topic, because it seems so Michael Asher. My favorite word in Hebrew is hineni. And it's when the burning bush, which was a tiny little bush burning, Moses walked by it day after day after day after day. He was busy. He was just, his mind was elsewhere. And in the Bible, it says one day he was just there. He was present and he noticed it. And he walked up to the bush and that was a whole different thing. But it's like Michael's piece. It, you know, you drive in, you drive out. It was a long driveway. There were bushes around, not bushes, but there was planting around it. And unless you were there, unless your mind was present, you were going to miss it. And it's kind of cool because those are the people who really saw it or knew to look. You know, it wasn't as obvious as bricks in the middle of the floor, you know.
Yeah, that's so well said. Absolutely. Yeah, that seems, again, like the epitome of his work.
It finds you.
Hidden in plain sight.
That's right. But it finds you when you're ready to see it.
Nancy, that's perfect. And I think he meant that with it.
I think so too.
It was at the beginning of the property. So you had a long driveway. It wasn't on the side of the property that most people came in. You know, he had a choice of any wall.
It wasn't obvious.
Yeah, so he made it not an obvious wall, even though it wouldn't have been on any of the walls. It was probably the least obvious space in the entire property. Because I think, like Nancy said, you know, if you're, I want you to be present if you see this.
And then was it easy to maintain? I guess it was sort of like as long as you kept the planting and kept everything as it was just sort of, it took care of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember there ever being an issue of maintenance. Do you, Ellen? Ann? I don't.
Not at all. Just when they painted that wall, they painted it.
Right. Just the usual sort of house stuff. Yeah.
And then in the original contract, he... And Stella and I thought a lot about this because we had to write a bit about, you know, we did a brochure. We're working on a brochure for the show where we write about every work. So we were thinking about this wall that he talks in the contract kind of about imagining the future of it. And the two things he imagines is either, well, I guess three things. He could imagine at some point if your family decided it wasn't useful anymore, they could just put it back. And he kind of mentions that as a possibility. Like it could be restored and made go away. It could be sold to the next owner. And he suggests like selling the wall for a certain price, like with the house, or it could be demoed or something like, and he imagines all three versions where like it lives or it doesn't live. There's one interview where he talks about it was really linked to the Grinsteins. It seems like as he reflected on it later, it was like its context was you guys and that family and all that. And so he was kind of comfortable with the idea that his work doesn't last forever, even though this one probably lasted among the longest of anything he's ever made. Because the thing about Michael Asher is like from after 1967, almost everything he made only lasted as long as the exhibitions. So he would make a site-specific project and it would last for the duration of the exhibition and then it would be gone forever. Or if there was a material trace, which is a lot of what we're showing in our show, the trace could live on or the element could live on, but the context would be gone. But I think there's a drinking fountain in San Diego at UCSD that he made that's a site-specific artwork that's still there. There's a stone in Korea where he etched some lettering, and I think the status of that's a little ambiguous. And then there's this. But this was the only work ever in private hands as a work. It was the only commission he ever did. It was the only privately owned work. So it occupied this utterly unique status, which is completely amazing in his work. But even given all that, he was also understood that it probably wouldn't last forever, you know?
Wow.
How much was the commission? I'm just curious.
I think it was $5,000. Is that right, Stella? That's what was the number in the contract.
Yeah, it was. And at first they were going to have some kind of an agreement where it was going to be leased, but then I think it ended up as a sale. And as somewhere in his notes, he says, actually, like, the price is arbitrary.
Well, it is an interesting concept when you're making a site-specific piece. It really is specific to that site. So it doesn't mean the same if it moves, because it was inspired and it was created because of what was around it. And so that is an interesting concept, that what'll happen to it is what happens to it, because it is part of this property.
Yeah, and it seems like that was really his ethics of working, was like it was the property and the social relations.
That's right.
What the work was actually expressing and participating in, and that if those conditions shift, then there's no work. But it seemed like from the late 60s, he'd already been very comfortable that that's the way he worked. He could step into a situation that where most of his work was hyper-temporal and did disappear, and it was very intrinsic to the way he worked, so there wouldn't be stress about that, as there would be for most other artists.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I know that Frank Gehry now, he won't build a building for just anybody. He has to have an affinity. And you see that, you see why. I mean, you just see why, because, you know, a relationship, love, hate, or otherwise, is what creates the art, you know, so that makes a lot of sense.
It's interesting. Nancy and I have talked about the house, and we're kind of happy it got torn down, because we wouldn't want to drive by and see someone else living there, because the house was so important to a period of time for us, for the artists.
To so many people.
And we said, so having strangers live there and their energy, it's like, the house was done. The house, we did a bit. My dad and mom had us, before they died, they asked us to have a goodbye party for all the artists. So they had a chance to say goodbye to the house, which we did. And I think Michael probably, when you said later on, he thought it was for the Grinsteins, that it was done. It was a very long show, but the show was over. You're not going to keep a piece up and have a different artist do a show and or have a different family. So I think his attitude was like what we said, you know, it was meant to be done, you know.
Yeah. No, that's kind of beautifully said. I think that's right.
Yeah, and I think that is true. It's like, you know, the house had its run, and which was 100 years, and the Asher piece went with it, you know, and which is kind of beautiful. You know, it ended up in the same ashes.
But lasted a couple of more years during the reconstruction.
Yeah. So people like me could go stare at it, you know, and it's kind of like zombie, half dead state. But you know, it would have been weird if it was sort of a different house, but the same wall, or like, Maybe just one step after another, the context eroded and changed and ended.
It was time. I mean, I'm glad it's not there because I feel like, you know, the people that are going to have, they're not worthy of it.
Right. And also, like Michael said, once the wall outlives its usefulness, then it doesn't that's need right. to be an artwork anymore. And I guess that's the same with the house.
Yes.
It doesn't really have a purpose.
That's right.
It already happened.
My mom at the end said, I'm done. And we're like, well, we don't want you to be done. She goes, I don't care. I'm done. Say goodbye. I'm done.
Ellen said to her, well, I'm going to miss you. And she goes, look at my picture.
I'm done. So it's kind of like the house. I'm tired. I'm done. We had some good times.
Yeah.
And the wall too.
I mean, it's really funny because I just said to friends who I was with the other night, I said, okay, picture the kitchen of Rockingham. And they were like, yeah. I go, yeah, that's where it lives. I can picture that wall perfectly. Like perfectly, I can picture his wall. And it's like, that's where it lives. And so it's interesting how we can say any room in the house to so many people and they'll go, got it. And it's like, that's where it lives. It has a new home.
And Ann, Nancy, and I'm sure can picture so many times having to explain to people why moving a wall 12 inches is a piece of art. More times than we want to count, but that's where it lives.
And it's funny because when we donated the Carl Andre piece and it came with documentation, and on the back of the documentation, it's Carl Andre wrote to my dad, just remember, it's just a pile of bricks, which is profound. You know, so it's like Michael Asher, it's just a wall. You know, and it's like, yeah, but, or yeah, and, but it's really, that's the beauty of it. You know, that's the beauty of it.
Because it was so interpersonal, what I want to ask, do you have many memories of him as an artist or his way or kind of him as in distinction to other artists that were there? He was like part of the milieu, right? But like, was there anything about his character that stood out or?
For me, the artist I spent most time with and a lot of time with were people who stayed at the house. So like Richard, Sarah lived at the house for 4 months?
Well, when he had hepatitis and...
Yeah, he had hepatitis and mono. He lived there and Rauschenberg was there quite a bit. And there was several artists who were there a lot. And they saw us come and go and were in the kitchen with us and in the living room. Because for me, I'm the youngest, so I was young. You know, I was a young kid. And Michael was just at the parties. He was at the house. A long explanation of a simple question. I didn't get to know him. I didn't, because I was just too young. Yeah.
What I remember of Michael, first I remember my dad when you would talk about Michael. It was like, you know, my dad loved Michael. He just loved him. That's my first impression. When you say Michael Asher, I feel my dad's heart just get bit. And that was, and there wasn't a lot of art. I mean, my dad loved all the artists, but with Michael, you knew there was a special place in his heart for him. And I think all three of us knew that. I always, again, like Nancy, there's certain artists I knew better. You know, Michael seemed a little shyer and just very quiet and sweet and kind. Yeah, there was a gentleness and almost a fragileness about Michael.
And like certain artists, you know, certain artists like to talk about their art, or they like to, you know, lecture about their art, or they like to be, you know, they like to be involved with the conversation. Michael seemed more... he has a bigger inner life. And so, you know, we had to be sensitive to that, of artists that actually didn't want to interact with us as much. Again, we were kids, you know, and a lot of these artists were not involved with kids. So, you know, and there were certain artists, like Ellen said, you know, that were more in our lives. So they were more, you know, interested in what we were doing or what we weren't doing, or conversations where Michael seemed much more cerebral to me, inner voice.
But there were some artists that we wouldn't talk to as much because they didn't want to be around kids or whatever, and we knew that. But with Michael, it wasn't like that. It was more like he was, because I think if he was sitting there and we sat, he would have talked to us and really cared and wanted to, but we were teenagers. We were looking at, you know, like Ed Boucher, so cute. Or, you know, I mean, it was
who had the best drugs.
Yeah, I mean, the artist didn't have the good drugs.
Did your dad stay close to Michael throughout his life?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I remember he was devastated when Michael passed. He, like I said, I think, well, Nancy, and I'm sure Anne would agree, Dad was different with Michael. There was a different love. He just loved Michael. He just thought he was the sweetest, nicest, brilliant, you know. I just remember there was a really special thing. And I remember when he went, how sad my dad was. And at the end, I forget how he passed away. How did he pass away?
I think it was a kind of heart issue in the end.
Yeah, because I think I remember my dad, again, we were fairly young and we were teenagers, so we weren't into that. But I think my dad was very trying to get Michael anything he needed. I remember that, you know, because he loved Michael.
Oh, that's so touching. Yeah, and all your memories, too, of him are really touching to hear. Even though that makes total sense that he wouldn't be the one that would be, like, the burning the brightest.
We were looking at the artists, like I said. Ed Boucher was really cute. McCollin was really cute. Chuck Arnaldi. You know, I mean, we're teenage girls. You know.
David Hockney wanted little to do with us. And he was around a lot, but he didn't want much to do with us until we were older. I mean, there was, you know, there's certain people like Frank Gehry became a family friend. Richard was a family friend. Philip Glass was a family friend, you know, and that's where, you know, we would have relationships outside of my parents with a lot of the artists. But it had to be time dependent. It really was time dependent.
Yeah.
Did you all study art in school?
I did. I don't think Ann and Ellen, did you?
I took an art history. I took one art history class.
That's right. And the other part that's kind of fun is, like, we had this piece out in the big gallery, which my mother, so this house was 100 years old. And my mother, at some point, when she became an architect, she pushed it out. It had, like, these beautiful glass, an atrium kind of look. And she pushed it out and raised it up and made it a gallery space out of this beautiful glass room, right? Because they needed more wall space.
Yeah, we saw photos of this, which is very beautiful.
That's very shameless. Beautiful, because they needed more wall space. So in this room was a Rauschenberg, an Ellsworth Kelly, Frank Stella. There was all these beautiful pieces. And then in the middle of the room, and the Brian Hunt, the Zeppelin, in the middle of the room was this string and this pendulum on the bottom. And we found out later, it was like a plum, you know, to plumb the. My mother got it at a swap meet. And it was, a lot of people, it was their favorite piece, just because it's such a cool piece on this long string, which is a two-story string with this thing on the bottom that's really heavy, that's for plumbing, you know, a straight line. And so they mixed stuff constantly, is my point. That's when I say it wasn't precious. It's like, next to all these amazing pieces of art is a piece that my mother got at a swap meet. So it was like, so what is beauty? What is grace? You know, and how it can occur anywhere and everywhere. And so we all knew that. And it was, so that was a really nice way to be introduced to creativity as well. You know, like Ellen said, it was the point of it. The point of it, that you were preserving it. Were you really preserving it? Well, maybe not. But it was the idea that was actually so sweet.
And I think that's why him and Michael loved each other so much. Because I think their philosophies about the complex of it, or you, not everyone needs to see this piece if they are rushing by and on their phones, or, you know. And I think my dad and Michael were on that level. If it's about the experience and the thought behind it.
Yeah, that makes so much sense.
And it's interesting about my mom that she had social anxiety, which is crazy thinking about the parties and everything. So what she would do to deal with that herself and her conflict, her inner conflict with it, is she would architect these parties. She would get all the liquor and the food, and she did things like a spread on that big table I was telling you about. She'd put sod, and then she would put cheeses and breads and mustards and salamis and just beautiful and fruit all on this piece of grass on this table. And then she would get a jukebox, and she would have everything set up. She would architect the whole thing and then go up to her room and read, because she was an avid reader. And then people, one by one, would go up and sit on the bed. And that was the big thing that people would do, is go sit on the bed with her for like an hour, hang out, because that she could handle.
Oh, that's so cool.
It was so cool. And like visit her, the queen. And so it was very cool where my dad was working the party. You know, he had nothing to do with the setup or the cleanup. He was just working the party because he was the people person. And so it was really interesting how they did that. And like I said, he was about the artist, she was about the art. And so it was really interesting the balance they had and how she dealt with her own social anxiety.
And they respected each other, except I think my mom didn't get the credit she deserved for how much she did, becoming an architect at 50, even credit from me till after she passed and Nancy and I started going through her papers and stuff, how brilliant she was and how she had the eye for the art. And my dad knew it. He loved the artist. My mom loved the art and was her eye. And it was like, it's sad to me that she didn't get the credit, but she...
I don't know if she would have wanted it.
Probably not, but still, it's just sad that I didn't respect. You know.
She's pretty shy in a sense. I mean, like, people who met her wouldn't think she was shy, but because she had this personality that could appear, but it was exhausting. I don't know if you know people that are real truly introverts and social anxiety. It's exhausting.
When being social, like, puts out their energy. Yeah, yeah,
yes,
yeah.
That's what I mean. Yep.
Well, we can't thank you enough for your time today, you guys. This is so great to, like, hear, I mean, about the Asher work, but also about, like, the whole context and the milieu. And, like, yeah, it was, I mean, really amazing to hear.